Hi, everyone. Welcome to Bible Discoveries, the weekend show. My name is Corey, and that's Matlock. Hey, Matlock.
Oh, hey.
Just throwing it over, just spicing it up.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
You are here. Okay, what?
No, I got a question for you this week.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so what are we studying, actually?
Okay.
I just have no clue, because I have been involved here. No, I know. Go ahead.
Jeremiah 49.
Yeah.
To Ezekiel 11 was our assigned reading this week, Monday to Saturday. So Jeremiah, Lamentations, and Ezekiel. And then we get Psalm 99 to 103 on Sunday is what you are supposed to read. So we're going to be recapping that Jeremiah 49 to Ezekiel 11. And then Matlock, you have a question.
Well, yeah. So we have a viewer question here that pertains more to you, is but history. It's from Bill 88. And he asks, "Hi, Corey Matlock. I enjoy your weekend show. I think it is amazing that Isaiah spoke about Cyrus's accomplishments 200 years before he was born. Is there any historical evidence about his upbringing and political ideas? How did he persuade the Medo-Persian Empire to go against the formidable Babylonians?"
Oh, yes.
For
yes,
after
yes, yes.
The recap.
That's right. We will right. do that after the recap. There is quite a bit of information about Cyrus. So I'm excited about that.
It is a good question. Yeah.
All right. Let's recap Jeremiah 49 to Ezekiel 11. Matlock, please jump in with pearls of wisdom as we go. Or questions.
It.
Or you'll think about it.
I'll think about it.
Forcing Matlock to come along with us on our Bible recapping journey. Okay. I'll be curious to know how many of you are keeping up with your reading or if you're leaning on these to get you caught up. There's no shame either way. I'm just curious. Let me know. Okay. Jeremiah chapter 49. We're told that Ammon, the nation of Ammon, took over the land from the tribe of Gad, the Israelite tribe of Gad, after they were conquered by Assyria. And so this is a prophecy that their capital city of Rabbah, the Ammonites' capital city of Rabbah, will be destroyed and the Israelites will retake their territory. Edom, there's a prophecy about Edom being taken. Damascus, also called Aram or Syria, because Damascus was the capital city of Aram, but it's sometimes called Syria, will be destroyed. We're told Kedar and Hazor. Now, these were nomadic tribes. This isn't referring to the city of Hazor, but the tribe of Hazor. They were living in the Arabian desert. We're told that Nebuchadnezzar is going to defeat them. Elam, a kingdom southeast of Babylon, will be destroyed and the people exiled, but they too will be restored in later days. That wraps up the prophecies of Jeremiah 49. Jeremiah 50, this prophecy is specifically for the big bad Babylonian Empire. Jeremiah prophesies that an alliance of people will destroy Babylon and Israel and Judah will be able to unite and travel back to Jerusalem to rebuild. I'm going to read you verses 6 and 7. It's God's description of Israel and Judah in the NIV. Here's what it says. "My people have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray and caused them to roam on the mountains. They wandered over mountain and hill and forgot their own resting place." We're also told that Babylon, it reveled in destroying God's people, and so they will be destroyed for their own evil. Jeremiah 51, the prophecy against Babylon continues into this chapter. This time the Medes are mentioned, and as we're going to discuss later on, it was an alliance between the Medes and the Persians that took Babylon, sort of an alliance, if you can call it that. We'll get there. We learn at the end of chapter 51 that Jeremiah had sent a scroll with this long prophecy against Babylon to Babylon with an official of King Zedekiah. Maybe they were going from Zedekiah to Babylon with the yearly tribute. That would be my guess. But we're given the official's name that Jeremiah sent the scroll with. His name is Seraiah, son of Neriah. Now, this is interesting because Jeremiah's scribe Baruch, his father's name is also Neriah. So could Seraiah be Baruch's brother? Seraiah was to read the scroll of Jeremiah's prophecy out loud once he reached Babylon, then tie a rock to the scroll and throw it into the Euphrates River and say, "So will Babylon sink to rise no more because of the disaster I will bring on her and her people will fall. Chapter 51 ends with the words, the words of Jeremiah end here. And then there's still another chapter of Jeremiah. But that's where the that's where the prophet's word words ends. So Jeremiah chapter 52 is a postscript, a PS. It records the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and the walls, the records of looting, the Babylonians looting the temple. It lists more exiles to Babylon. And there's a record of Jehoiachin, king for 3 months, Jehoiachin of Jerusalem, being released from prison in Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar's son, Awal Marduk, or Evil Merodach. However, the English translations vary. But that's the end of Jeremiah.
So who wrote Jeremiah? Did you do Baruch? Or possibly. Do we know? Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah, unclear.
Oh, wow.
Probably Baruch.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know who else would be around.
Could be a later editor.
Killed. Yeah.
Could be a later editor.
Even in exile? Maybe in exile, they were just documenting everything that happened. It would have to be because they're documenting all the...
They documented the release of Jehoiachin. Yeah. And that is accurate. So interestingly, a segment of the Babylonian Chronicle was randomly selected for translation, I think at the British Museum. And it ended up being the record of King Jehoiachin's release.
Right.
And rations. That is amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Because it verifies what Jeremiah 52 says happened to him.
So yeah, so these are the people in exile being like, look, everything Jeremiah prophesied did come true.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that's ratifies what I think you see this often in the prophets where it's called First Samuel. And then like the end of First Samuel, he dies. And then there's Second Samuel.
Yeah.
Like who's writing this? Anyways, maybe Gad, maybe Nathan.
Or like Deuteronomy recording the death of Moses after it says that Moses has been writing it this whole time. Well, it's probably Joshua who took over for Moses.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, I know. That's interesting though.
All of those things. Okay. But then we do jump back into a work that was authored by the prophet Jeremiah and its Lamentations. Yes. So Lamentations is five poems, essentially, this is how I would describe it, five poems about the destruction of Jerusalem, specifically crying over, lamenting, mourning, remembering the destruction of Jerusalem. So Lamentations 1, Jerusalem is personified and laments her own fallen condition. Lamentations chapter 2, the Lord is giving credit for Jerusalem's destruction. So the Babylonians did it, but it ultimately was the Lord. And the prophet begins to lament and mourn and calls for the city to cry out to God. And the city does cry out to God in Lamentations 2. In Lamentations 3, we get this personal perspective being taken out, describing the awful horrors of the wrath of God. And then there's hope. Verses 19 to 26 says this, I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them. And my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore I will wait for him. The Lord is good to those whose hope is in him. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been universally recognized as beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
You know, throughout church history, great is thy faithfulness. It's a
wonderful
hymn.
It's a hymn, yeah.
Okay, Lamentations chapter 4, the destruction of Jerusalem is spoken of with vivid descriptions of the results of the siege of the city. So starvation, death, cannibalism of the dead. It's a very bleak chapter. And it connects the destruction of the city to the corruption of the prophets and priests. And it likens the prophets and priests to the blind and the unclean. So the prophets, those who claimed to see spiritual truths, are blind. And the priests, those who claimed to be holy, to be set apart, to be other, to be clean, to be better than, are so unclean that the people living in squalor are telling them to go away because they're too unclean.
Mm.
And there's also, in Lamentations 4, a direct address to the nation of Edom, to stop rejoicing over Jerusalem's fall, because she too will be destroyed. And then finally in Lamentations 5, there's a call, a cry out to God to save the people, to specifically remember the people. And that concept, the concept of remembering, God remembering, is used often of God. Like, think about in Exodus. This wasn't trying to say, like, oh, God has a faulty memory. He forgets things. But it's that saying functionally, he was not acting on their behalf. So to remember the people was to actively act or engage in helping or fixing or rescuing them. Lamentations 5 also describes some of the hardships and atrocities that were experienced by the captured Judeans at the hands of their captors. It's a brutal read. And that's the end of Lamentations. Okay, ready to jump into Ezekiel?
Yeah, let's do it. I'm just reading. Yeah, it's good.
Ezekiel's a wild ride.
Yes.
Are you ready for Ezekiel?
Oh my goodness.
Buckle up.
Are we going in?
We're going in.
To the depths.
Or the heights.
Oh.
Of Ezekiel's visions. Okay, yeah. Ezekiel chapter 1. We meet 30-year-old Ezekiel. He was a Judean exile, taken in the first wave of exiles with King Jehoiachin from Jerusalem. And in this chapter, Ezekiel has a vision, a very famous vision of the throne of God. And it's a throne that moves. So it's sometimes referred to as the chariot throne of God. So it has wheels that I will say sees all things, has eyes all around it. And there's cherubim, or four living creatures. They have human bodies with four faces, the face of a man, the face of a lion, the face of an ox, and the face of an eagle. They have four wings. With two of the wings, they cover their body, and with two wings, they fly. They fly in square formation with their wing tips touching. There's a vault like crystal. There's a throne like lapis lazuli. Luzi, I don't know how you say that even. Help me out, geologists. God in human form is seen, and it ends, this vision ends with Ezekiel falling on his face when he sees the glory of God. Seems appropriate. Okay, maybe we could talk about some potential significance here.
Okay.
Potential significance, sure. from my like angle, okay?
Okay, go ahead.
Because there's a lot of memes on the internet right now about like how we think of angels versus how the Bible talks about angels. There's many different kinds of creatures that the Bible talks about. But potential significance here of God having a chariot throne or being mobile.
Yeah.
Was this meant to reinforce the concept that the temple had been decommissioned by God? Because rather than the presence of God meeting with people in the temple, he's now meeting with Ezekiel from like this chariot throne. Maybe. God is also described specifically as approaching Ezekiel from the north. Now, in the contemporary work of the prophet Jeremiah, coming from the north is always associated with the enemy coming to destroy. So this is perhaps Ezekiel seeing that it is actually God coming against Jerusalem and Judah,
right?
Which goes along with what God says through all the other prophets, that I'm using Babylon to destroy, but it's actually me bringing judgment on your evil.
Mm.
Thoughts? I don't know. Let me know what you think. Ezekiel chapter 2. When we left Ezekiel in chapter 1, he was flat on his face. So God helps Ezekiel to stand up in chapter 2, and he calls him as a prophet. Sent specifically to the rebellious of Israel, meaning the people of God, both Israel and Judah, because in exile, there's this reforming, this reunification of Israel and Judah that happens. They're all exiled now. Ezekiel is told not to be afraid of the people of God and also not to be rebellious like them. He's given a scroll of mourning and weeping, and he's told to eat it. So then in chapter 3, he eats it, and we're told it tastes like honey. Then he's told to go speak to Israel specifically, not to foreigners, because, and this is an indictment on Israel, because surely they would listen to you, God says.
Well.
God, what?
Go ahead, no, continue.
to finish this chapter, God takes Ezekiel up with his chariot throne and brings him back to the exiles at the Kibar River where he was before this vision happened. And Ezekiel is told that he must tell these people God's warnings or their blood will be on Ezekiel's hands. So if I warn them through you and you choose to shut up, their blood's on your hands. So just tell them. God tells Ezekiel to go to the plain and he sees the glory of God again. And Ezekiel has to go into seclusion until God opens his mouth. Like he literally can't speak. So he has to, until God tells him, okay, now you can go talk to the people.
So interestingly, a little something interesting, not that it's like, probably won't amount to anything more than just being interesting. When Ezekiel eats the scroll.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's as sweet as honey. This is what's described in Revelation with John, Revelation chapter 10, eating the little scroll. But here again, it says it tastes as sweet as honey, right? In both accounts. But in John's, it's as bitter to his stomach. Mm. But right after this in Revelation, where he eats the little scroll, just like Ezekiel did, two witnesses go out. And one of those witnesses, right? Mm-hmm. We often talk about Enoch, Elijah, Moses. But they go out and they prophesy against the city. Mm-hmm. So it's very similar to this Ezekiel language of what has to happen. Anyways, that's it.
It's worth further study and thinking about how do the first few chapters of Ezekiel relate to those chapters in Revelation, because clearly there's a thematic and symbolic connection between the eating of the scroll.
Well, of course,
the consuming of the scroll.
You live not on just bread alone, but every word that comes from the mouth of God. So literally, like you're eating the word of God.
But
like quite literally, that's what's being encapsulated here.
Yes.
But do you see what I'm saying?
But specifically, this scroll in Ezekiel contains mourning and weeping over the judgment of God.
That's right. But that's what Revelation's about.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, so in this case, okay, so that's why it's bitter to his stomach. Mm-hmm. So there's something about eating the word of God and it being, there's a relationship there that needs to be explored.
Absolutely.
I've yet to explore it, but I'm just throwing this out there.
Absolutely.
Anyways, go ahead.
Okay, Ezekiel chapter 4. Ezekiel is told to symbolize the coming besiegement of Jerusalem by making a clay model of the city. Arts and crafts, again, love it.
That's Revelation. That's the two witnesses. I know, it's interesting. Anyways.
He has to lay on his side outside, like beside the model of the city for a certain number of days. He had to measure his food, as in ration it out. And God tells him to cook his food using human waste as fuel. And to that, Ezekiel's like, now hold on. He resists. And God then allows him, he makes a concession, he allows Ezekiel to use animal dung. So this is like going to the extreme of how unclean it's going to be and how brutal the besiegement's going to be. And it was that brutal, but God gave Ezekiel a little bit of mercy here. Ezekiel chapter 5, Ezekiel has to shave his head, which was not done in the mourning practices of Israel. You can read about it in Deuteronomy. He has to shave his head and beard and divide it in thirds. The first third he burns, the second third he strikes with the sword, and the last third he scatters to the wind. But before he does so, he saves a few hairs back and tucks them into his garment, but then plucks out a couple of them and burns them.
Oh.
Yeah. So this is a very complex drama, but it's symbolic of what's going to happen to the population of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And it's explained in detail in Ezekiel chapter
5. Not even the remnant will be spared.
Some of the remnant is going to die as well.
Yes.
It's going to be burned. Ezekiel chapter 6. This continues the prophecy against Israel. This time specifically against Israel's mountains with their shrines and incense altars, saying they will be smashed. Ezekiel's told to stamp his feet, strike his hands together, and mourn and wail out, alas, alas, because of the prophecies. Ezekiel chapter 7. God, in first person, explains and poetically describes the destruction of Judah. Let me read you a few verses 20 to 21, NIV. They took pride in their beautiful jewelry and used it to make their detestable idols. They made it into vile images. Therefore, I will make it a thing unclean for them. I will give their wealth as plunder to foreigners, and as loot to the wicked of the earth who will defile it. So the thing they loved and tainted with false worship will be the thing that invites their destruction. The enemy will destroy them to get at that very thing, to get at their wealth. Ezekiel chapter 8. Ezekiel gets taken up by the hair. So it's grown back by this point in Ezekiel 8. And he gets taken to the Jerusalem temple in a vision. And he sees the unnamed idol that they had set up in the temple of God. And they have decorated the interior of the temple with animals and with insects. And there were more idols. And there were women mourning for Tammuz. We know that Tammuz was a god whose death was mourned yearly with the vegetation. So it was like a seasonal, agricultural god. And there were men in Jerusalem worshiping the sun. In Ezekiel chapter 9, we have God has servants mark the foreheads of those who were mourning over what was going on, over these evil practices, saying that those people would be spared, but everyone else would be killed indiscriminately. It's brutal when you read it in Ezekiel chapter 9. And we've got to remember, this is a vision of God's judgment through the Babylonians, but it's speaking specifically to what the evil Babylonians will do. They will indiscriminately and brutally murder all in the city of Jerusalem once the siege is broken. What God is saying here is that he is going to move to save those who mourn over the evil that they're witnessing in their day-to-day lives. And this rescue happens partially, we're told, through the first exile. For example, that Ezekiel had been a part of, and partially through God's miraculous provision, like in the case of Jeremiah and Baruch and Ebed-Melech, who we learned back in the book of Jeremiah, were captured in Jerusalem after the siege was broken, but were not killed and were actually let go. Okay, a couple more chapters left here. Ezekiel 10. After this sort of cleansing of the temple, meaning the destruction of the temple, God's presence leaves. It leaves the temple. And Ezekiel again describes the cherubim or the four living creatures. And Ezekiel 11, God brings Ezekiel to the east gate of the temple where there were 25 men, leaders of Jerusalem, giving the people evil advice. And God has him prophesy against those 25 men. And as he's doing it, one of the men drops dead in the vision. And Ezekiel stops prophesying. He falls face down and he cries out to God, basically, please stop. He says, alas, sovereign Lord, will you completely destroy the remnant of Israel? God promises then and there to bring back scattered Israelites to come and take away remaining idolatry in the land. God's presence leaves Jerusalem and it rests on the Mount of Olives. And that's the very ominous end of Ezekiel chapter 11. So you can see why the true prophets of God at this point in time are not going to be really popular.
Yeah, but it leads the way because it's talking about how a new heart and new spirit is going to come. And then in Ezekiel 36, it happens, right? Before the new temple is constructed in the Ezekiel chapter 40 and onwards. Which is all very interesting, the timing and the pattern of how it all works. If you just look at the order of the events that take place, sometimes it's just helpful just to, what's good about these summaries is that you can break down just the raw order of something happening, because so much misunderstanding comes from not just breaking down raw order. Because then you can see, oh, this goes to there, then that happens. And then you can just see very plainly what's happening on the great meta narrative of it all, as opposed to just, What does this section say? Then piecing together two different sections out of order, right? That disorderliness just leads to misinterpretation and confusion. But no, this is all very interesting. The cherubim, this whole wheels within a wheel thing. I know it wants me to say UAPs and UFOs, but we're not going to go there today.
Aliens.
It's not aliens. Everyone wants me to go there, but we know. But we're not going to go there. Anyways, but I just think it's really interesting because here you have something where you have like it's like wheels overlapping with wheels in this weird, like kind of like a gyroscope-ish way. And, but at the very end, it says, these angels that are by these wheels and God's hovering over the cherubim, right? Kind of like the ark. But then each one, it says each one of them went straight forward in their own direction. So this,
according to the direction that, of the wheels, right?
Yes.
Like we have to think from an ancient context.
Yes.
Of wheels for them weren't spaceships. They weren't flying saucers.
Yes.
They were chariots, right? Yes. Like this is, we see that the purpose of the cherubim wheels are movement. It is movement.
Yes. And they all go their different directions.
Yes.
So the wheels have a purpose behind it.
Yes.
So you think about processions. You think about moving the ark, transporting the ark. Mm-hmm. And then you see how the Spirit of God leaves the temple, right? But then he's going to put a new heart and a new spirit into mankind, into all those who seek after him kind of thing. So you see that this is what's coming here. So, so the glory of God, which hovers above the mercy seat, right, is coming to, you know, a person near you. Like it's coming, right? It's coming, right? Is this idea. Anyways, so there's something else that's deeper that's happening here. And of course, it's the throne room of God. Now, here's a question for you, which I was just thinking about, but not really meditating on, just kind of passing thought. This chariot-like language is used to describe the wheels within the wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And Ezekiel being pulled out, basically not teleported, but it says in his vision, teleported to like a time and a place to prophesy. So now you think about this. Now, compared to Elijah, when he's taken up in the chariot of fire, would that chariot look anything like this? Like what's the descriptions? Are they similar enough that you could be like, well, like it's actually similar to this chariot that's described in Ezekiel? What do you think?
So I think that the chariots, plural, that we read about when Elijah is taken up into heaven, he's actually taken up in the whirlwind. And Elisha says, my Lord, the chariots and the horsemen of Israel. So I think, from my understanding, you guys let me know what you think. I think Elisha is actually seeing a vision of the army of God rather than the chariot throne of God.
Right.
And I think Ezekiel is seeing the chariot throne of God because that's what he's describing. He sees even God. Like the glory of God.
Right.
But Elisha doesn't say like, oh, the glory of God. He says the chariots and the horsemen of Israel.
Yeah, right.
So we've got like the chariots of fire, like. Thanks so much for joining us today. I really hope you enjoyed the discussion. If you want to finish off the discussion and hear an extra bonus question that Matlock and I are going to talk about, then hop on over to our YouTube channel, which is my name, Corey Babechko. You can even join us in the comment section if you want.